Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Today, we are pleased on the HR Power Hour to have in-depth interviews of the four gubernatorial candidates of the great state of Maine. These interviews have been designed to be a positive conversation with the candidates, where we focus on real issues and concerns that business leaders, HR professionals, and employees care about today. I have some questions that I have created, but I have also asked some business leaders and show listeners their thoughts and built questions. After this interview, I will interview the additional candidates and I will ask them the basic questions. They may or may not get follow-up questions based on their answers, and not all questions may be asked of each candidate based on answers or time. Please note, the views, opinions, and conclusions expressed by the candidates on this show are those of the candidate and not necessarily those of the HR Power Hour radio show, its ownership, sponsors, or Atlantic Coast Radio. The content of this show has not been approved, and each candidate is solely responsible for his or her content. Their appearance does not constitute an endorsement. Today, I, David Chulo, your host of the HR Power Hour, have the pleasure of speaking with Terry Hayes, who is running for governor as an independent candidate for the great state of Maine. According to her website, HayesForMaine.com, Terry is Maine's first independent state treasurer, and both Republicans and Democrats have twice elected Terry to serve in this position. And it says that that is because she consistently has risen above partisan fray and helped to right the financial ship of the state. She has graciously taken some time out of her busy schedule with us today, and I'm truly looking forward to discussing her vision for the next 4 years. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David. It's really an honor to be here.
Well, great. No, I appreciate you having me on. We are having a great time interviewing all the candidates. And look, Maine employers and Maine employees make a difference every day, right?
Huge difference every day, right? Yes.
So I have some basic questions to start with, and we'll go through them, and I appreciate your candor.
Sure.
All right, so first, what is the personal reason you're running for governor?
I love Maine. I've been majoring in Maine for 60 years, and I consider this my capstone project. And I mean that genuinely. I think that we have so much potential that we get distracted and caught up in conflicts that at the end of the day don't help us move Maine forward. And I think this is an opportunity, you know, for Maine to have someone who can see that potential and work with everyone who's brave enough to step into the policy arena. I don't pick sides with either of the parties. I find that everyone that I've met, and I mean everyone that's been elected to serve and that I've worked with in the last 12 years in Augusta with different hats on my head, but if they've put their name on a ballot, they're doing it because they love Maine too. And we forget that we have much more in common than we have that separates us. And I want to bring that vision and that perspective to the Blaine House with an opportunity to lead Maine in that direction.
So what in your background or what have you done with your life that makes you feel you're qualified to run for the state of Maine chief executive officer job?
There are several things. What I'd like to point out to folks is that I have served in all three branches of Maine state government for 7 years or more consecutively. And I've owned and operated two businesses. So I've been in a position where I've had to meet payroll and take care of those broader issues that you know, when you talk about HR, that the business owner has to deal with. One of those businesses I sold when I was done with it, and the other one I closed. It wasn't one that had a value beyond my participation at that point. So I believe I bring meaningful public sector experience and private sector experience to this role. And in the last 4 years, I've been the state treasurer, the first independent elected to that office by the legislature. And I've had an opportunity to work with the current administration and the legislature, both parties and independents, to help get us to the point where we're paying our bills, the state is paying its bills with our own money, and we're doing it on time. And that's the way we should run government. So as Maine's next governor, I want to keep it there. I think, you know, not messing that up is at the top of the to-do list, okay? You know, there've been a variety of things that have happened over the last 8 years to get us here, and I'm very conscious of the fact that if we're gonna build a Maine that we want to leave for our children, our grandchildren, we have to take care of that along the way. So I think that my combined experience, my temperament, my capacity and respect for others who are willing to do this work, whether or not I agree with them on a particular policy issue, I think all of those things qualify me for this job.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show on WLOB Radio, and I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Terry Hayes, who's running for governor as an independent candidate for the state of Maine. Terry, I think it's fair to say that Maine's economy has certainly improved over the last 4 years. Job growth has been strong, unemployment's at 2.7%. Tax revenue is also strong, especially on the business side. And Mainians basically say consumer confidence is nearing a record high. Why should we change course in what we're doing, or why?
Well, actually, I don't know that I would be advocating a significant change in course. I think the biggest challenge that we have in our economy right now is workforce. That when you cite the 2.7% unemployment rate, that's actually full employment, which means there are literally thousands of jobs across the state of Maine that are unfilled at the moment. So imagine what our surplus would be if all those jobs were filled and those individuals are earning wages, paying income tax, and participating in the economy with the sales tax revenues and so forth. So at the top of the to-do list, beyond making sure we live within our means, because that's the functional piece, when we look at what do we need to do in the broader sense with regard to the economy, it's finding ways to attract skilled workers to Maine so that we can connect them with the employers. Because right now, if we don't fill those positions, those companies we're going to have difficult time maintaining, and they're certainly not going to be able to grow. So making Maine the best state in the country to work in is the way I like to frame this. And that means what is it that will bring people to Maine? What do we have that they want? Because we have lots of things that they want. We take things for granted, and I would suggest we haven't marketed Maine as a work destination. We've marketed Maine as a play destination. And so the challenge is to take that book of business that we have very good at inviting visitors. You know, we love company. We have 35 to 41 million visitors come to Maine every year. So how do we take less than 0.05% of those visitors and turn them in to stay here instead of just play here, we can solve our workforce challenges. So I think it's a matter of focusing on that, being welcoming, recognizing that international immigrants are going to help us close that gap, finding ways to get immigrants participating in our economy faster when they get here. And, you know, it's making sure we're paying attention to our worker pipeline, which is our publicly funded education systems, and, you know, repatriating Mainers who left when we didn't have their jobs here, but we have them now. So for me, as Maine's next governor, you know, you're going to know whether I've been successful in working with folks. You know, there are two different things that are relatively underway right now. Probably the biggest one is the Maine Spark Initiative. I want to help the folks. There are some over 40 organizations participating in that collaborative effort to do exactly this, to help match qualified and skilled workers with those positions that are going open right now in Maine's economy. So to me, that's at the top of the list. It's, you know, we need to have folks and connect them with those jobs and do it as quickly as possible. And if we fail at that, you'll know. You know, it's a collaborative effort, but I'm more than willing to take on that as at the top and make sure that when I'm talking about Maine, I'm talking about why I love it. I might have been born here by accident, but I've stayed on purpose. And when I meet with people and we talk about this, I love to ask them, when did you come and why? You know, because if we lead with what we love about Maine, whether it's the natural beauty, the natural resources, you know, abundant coastline, the clean water, clean air, relative lack of traffic, depending upon where you come from.
True.
A great place to raise kids, you know, with multiple opportunities. So, you know, if we lead with those and we make sure that the rest of the world knows that we have what some of them want – we can get them to come.
A follow-up to that question is that companies must compete today in ways that no one ever thought of. The training and technology skills for today's workforce have affected the way companies do business and what they need to survive and compete. It's created a shortage, as you just stated, of tech workers and skilled workers here in the state. Mm-hmm. What can you really do as governor? What specifics can you really do to solve this problem?
I describe this as changing a tire on a moving vehicle. I'll think about that. Mm. Okay. There are efforts already underway because the private sector has been aware of these challenges. It's not news to them. So I think what I will do as governor is be directly connected to folks like Maine Focus, Maine Spark, the FOR initiative within the forest products industry. You know, these are efforts where the industry or leaders in the private sector have come together to coalesce around some solutions. And I think my job is to help them do that. So I need feedback from them. Where are the policy pieces? Where state government can help them do what they're trying to do? I mean, if you think about it, the Maine Spark Initiative says the goal by 2025, we will have 60% of the adults in Maine will have a meaningful credential for work. So that's training. That's training folks that are here already, training and retraining them. That's a very measurable goal, and there are, like I said, a whole variety of entities that are all working together in order to achieve that goal. And as Maine's next governor, I want to know from them, how can I help? What do you need from me and the legislature that will help reach that goal? Because as it's articulated, is exactly what we need to do. When the Focus Maine initiative is looking at, you know, three specific areas of the economy, but they're also really looking at knowledge workers. And that's what you're talking about here with the tech skills and tech industry. So what are they doing? They've created and then replicated this wonderful summer internship program to keep young people in Maine over the summer, or to bring them here and have them work in, you know, paid internships in some of our more tech-savvy companies, you know, whether it's IDEX or WEX and other companies, you know, in greater Portland. You know, I laugh about this because our university system, you know, the enrollment from out-of-state students has been going up, and which is a success story. But think about it. They get here in late August, and we send them home in early May. You know, very few of us are going to live through January, February, March and go someplace else for June, July, and August, you know. So there are multiple reasons what we can take some of those folks that are here for some other reason. That's a book of business. Those students from other states or other parts of the world, and find ways to keep them here during that glorious part of the year that is our reward for the winter months. And then make sure that during that time, they're not just having an experience, if you will, relative to the workplace, but they're able to play here too.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show on WLOB Radio. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Terry Hayes, who's running for governor as independent candidate for the state of Maine. Question one, Terry, is a very hot-button issue for employers in the state. The initiative states, quote, "Do you want to create a universal home care program to provide home-based assistance to people with disabilities and senior citizens, regardless of income, funded by a new 3.8 tax on individuals and family with Maine wage, and adjusted gross income above the amount subject to Social Security taxes, which is $128,400 in 2018? Very simple. Employers want to know, do you support this question? If you do or don't, why? And how do you think it will affect employers and job growth in the state if it passes?
I don't support this initiative. I don't think that we should raise taxes in this way. I think that programs have to compete in the entire fabric of what the state government is going to provide its citizens. And when we take one particular need out and frame it this way, it's to our detriment, in my opinion. And I don't believe that it's too easy for anyone to say, well, sure, I'd like to have X as long as somebody else pays for it. And I object to that frame. This is not the first question that we've had that operates this way, but it is not, it does not generate good public policy. We had a 55% for education question 14 years ago on the ballot, and it passed, but we haven't done it yet, right?
That's true.
So, you know, it makes me ask the question, well, maybe it was the right problem, but the wrong solution. And when it's a citizen's initiative, You know, the way that works, the initiative itself is written by the advocates, and there's no opportunity to amend it. It's the only way to pass, to have a proposal become a law in Maine without any amendment until after it's a law. And that's just the way the process works. And I don't think this is the approach that we should be using to meet those kinds of needs. To the extent that we need that program or those program outcomes, we should be addressing those in terms of the entire state budget and the entire tax system for the state of Maine. So I do not support the question.
As a quick follow-up to that, do you support efforts in the state, or will you, as governor, to change the way citizen initiatives get approved in terms of needing signatures from different counties or different districts?
I actually suggest a different way of solving this. I look at it systemically. So where do these questions come from? They're written by advocates. Why are the advocates putting them on the ballot? Well, the answer is because they get to write the whole law. So the question that you read as this topic came up, David, it said there's like an 18-page law,
yes,
or bill behind
it, yeah,
that the vast majority of us don't read,
right,
before voting on. And again, it can't be amended anywhere in the process. I would suggest we're going to have to change our Constitution to make any changes to Citizens Initiative. I would suggest that we take out the part that you write the law, and we would just consider these what we call in the legislature a concept draft. So the only question would be the question on the ballot. Here's an example. Do you want to legalize adult recreational use of marijuana? Yes or no. Do you think the minimum wage needs to be raised in Maine? Yes or no. But with no bill behind it. And then if the measure passes, the legislature writes the law. And in that process, there's an opportunity for all the interest groups and stakeholders to participate, to have a voice, to offer amendments and so forth to the structure. I think we get better outcomes. And from my perspective, I'd rather change that part of the system than mess with where the signatures come from. I think structurally we diminish the incentive, if you will, for an interest group if they can't write the law, you know. So, and that to me is where there's a wrinkle in the process.
All right, Terry, the voters of the state of Maine voted to continue to increase the minimum wage, as we just talked about, every year for the next few years, and then index it after that. Mm-hmm. It's currently $10 an hour. Some say that's not enough. It should go to $15, heck, even $20 an hour. What's your position on the minimum wage? Because it does affect what employers pay, and it does, mm-hmm, affect employment. And do you see your new administration dealing with this statewide if elected?
Very good question. And I'll go back to what I was saying before. I mean, here is a law that became law without any opportunity to amend it. So I don't think that folks should be surprised if, now that we're implementing it, if we decide that it's in our best interest to make some changes, because we didn't have that opportunity at any other point along the way. I don't come to the ballot for governor with a particular outcome in mind with regard to this, but I won't be surprised if there's an initiative in the legislature. And I do recognize that we experience our economy differently in different parts of Maine. And that's a challenge that we have, because typically we're doing things that are one size fits all. And what is our tolerance for doing them differently in different parts and different regions of our state based on economic outcomes? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm open to the conversation. So, you know, I don't want businesses to not be able to have the help that they need because we're in this escalated minimum wage component. And if that happens, particularly in some of our more rural parts of the state, we are, in fact, you know, creating precisely the outcome we're trying to avoid. We're trying to find how to encourage and support the local economy in those regions. So I'm open. I have an open mind about this. Because, in fact, the Citizens Initiative process does not allow for any amendments, I think we have to recognize that there are likely to be changes once something of that proposal becomes a law. And I'm more than willing to work with legislators to see what would make sense and whether or not a regional approach would make sense.
Just a quick follow-up to that. Some of the cities and towns have started to look at their own minimum wage, which are typically above the state minimum wage. And right now it appears to be okay to do so. There's some question in terms of the constitutionality. Right at this point, that's where it seems to be. Do you support each city or town having their own minimum wage and having a checkmate all through the whole state of different minimum wages?
You know, it sounds complicated if I'm an employer, especially if I have multiple locations, you know, and if my business has multiple locations in Maine. But again, I'm looking at this and saying, I don't think we've had this conversation, at least not one that I've been able to observe or participate in, whether one size fits all. If one size doesn't fit all for the minimum wage because it might be going up too high, you know, I have to look at it and say, well, you can't have regional differences if you're not willing to have to tolerate those differences in this setting. It's a big I don't know, I guess. So I'm open to the conversation, but I don't. It is not a piece that a policy priority that I'm bringing to say I want to stop this or change it.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Terry Hayes, who is running for governor as an independent candidate for the state of Maine. Big topic, and affecting not only employers but employees across the state, the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem with employers and employees. Work production is being affected. It's mm-hmm. affecting families. How will your administration deal with this crisis, assist in the opioid epidemic, go forward?
Well, at the personal level, we need to recognize that one of the challenges and one of the reasons that this has grown to a crisis stage is a stigma to substance abuse. And folks who find themselves caught in this brain disease don't reach out for help. It takes them a lot longer to because shame is attached to it. There's judgment that is. And I have to say, we have to speak about this differently. And generally, literally, open our arms and welcome people to treatment. So, and without the judgment component to it, because we need them, because they're valuable assets in our economy, because we love them. They're parts of our family and in our neighborhood and our friends. So part of this is attitudinal in language, you know, and in breaking away. There's been a lot of judgment in the conversations about substance abuse and whether or not, you know, interventions should be available at the time of overdose. There's a lot of judgment in those conversations. As Maine's next governor, I will not be speaking about these things with that judgment layer. I think that is one of the things that prevents people from coming forward. The other thing that, you know, this is a real example of where the partisanship has gotten in the way. We've known this. We've been using the word crisis now for 6 years regarding this issue, the opioid crisis. And why is it we haven't been able to make some significant inroads? And it's a tit for tat. Who's up? Who's down? It's scorekeeping, and it's not helping anybody because the problem is not partisan, and the solution shouldn't be either. Okay, we're going to have to do programming around access, education, law enforcement, and treatment. So how we frame it, framing it without a judgment, a brain disease, just as if, you know, if someone had cancer, we don't judge them because they have cancer. We can't judge people because this is their challenge. And recognizing that we're going to have to put up some money to help provide more what I call on-demand treatment. Right now, if you are struck with this disease and you reach out for help, you're on a wait list in most communities in Maine, and you could be on there for as long as 6 months. Well, what is that like for that 6 month period of time? You know, we need to ramp up access so that when someone's ready, we're ready there to help them. And that's key. And part of that is going to be drawing down some federal money to help us do that, as well as putting up some state funds. We haven't invested in this crisis. We're calling it a crisis for 6 years, and we haven't put any of our own money in a significant way to help meet those needs so that we can turn it around.
The state has passed recreational marijuana, and there's been a lot wrangling over the regulations and details, of course, of how it's been rolled out. Employers are still not 100% sure what they can and cannot do, for example, in regards to the workforce. Currently, for example, there's a complete difference between how you can handle an employee discipline in regards to alcohol versus marijuana. That doesn't seem fair. A lot of employers are concerned about that. And is that really fair to the employee? What's your position on marijuana, and how do you plan to deal with this and these inconsistencies as governor?
Good question, David. I favored and voted in support of legalizing adult recreational use of marijuana. And my take on the challenges that you've described are that we're not the first state to end up in this situation, and there are others who essentially have gone there before us, whom we can learn from. I've been challenged as the state treasurer around this issue because of the banking challenges. This is an industry that, because of the conflict between state legalization and federal banking rules and criteria, much of it is a cash business. And what challenges that presents for the state, collecting taxes and licensing fees and so forth, and how much more expensive it is when we're working with cash. And we don't have electronics, you know, to help facilitate. You know, that's a real challenge.
Sure.
So I understand the concerns that employers have. I don't have personal experience with ferreting out or researching, if you will, how this is being handled, for example, in California, in Colorado, in Washington State, in Oregon. These are all states that were ahead of us in the process. So I suspect we can learn something from them, some suggestions. I'm really open to learning more from our employers across the state of what we can do at the policy level that protects them, their customers, and the outcomes that they're looking for. I'm not offering something that I'm bringing to the table. I'm in a learning mode.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show on WLOB Radio. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Kerry Hayes, who's running for governor as independent candidate for the state of Maine. And we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelly Flagg, general manager of the Body Architect Fitness Center in Portland, Maine. I want to personally invite you to come meet us. If you've been considering joining a gym but haven't yet because you're a little nervous or just plain old don't like the gym, come see us. We have created a 30-day personal training experience just for you. Meet our trainers, try a few workouts, and use our facility for 30 days for just $79. Call 774-2196 or visit thebodyarchitect.com today.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, you are listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show on WLOB. I am your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Kerry Hayes, who is running for governor as independent candidate for the great state of Maine. Kerry, welcome back. Second half, ready?
Thank you, absolutely.
All right, let's go. Here we go. One of the issues that employers say is a huge concern and a major factor in hiring is the uncertainty when it comes to the cost of health care. Mm-hmm. Costs are going up, and I've been told that premiums this year could be going up as much as double digit in certain areas. How do we get a grip on this rising cost that affects employers and employees, and what is your administration's plan to address this?
Well, it's a significant systems challenge, and if you study how it came to be this way, I mean, that, if you think about that, David, no one sat down 120 years ago and said, how do we create this? And this is the ideal way it would look. So there's an interesting historical path that brings us to the present, and it's also what challenges us to make significant changes. Right now, and on my to-do list, will be expanding Medicaid, because there is a segment of the population, and these are by and large people that are in fact working, and working in businesses that aren't able to or can't afford to offer health insurance to their employees. It's the working poor that we will pick up, and that will help take some of the pressure off the costs that we all are driving up in our the private insurance rates. So we need to do that. We need to expand Medicaid. I believe that's best for all of us. But we also have to recognize that system has a gap in it. By definition, the costs of the care that's provided and the reimbursement rates within the program have a gap. And if we don't address that as we're expanding Medicaid, we're going to have a real challenge paying for this downstream. So we need to bring – I don't know that we can close the gap, but we have to bring the cost down and the reimbursement rates up. So in terms of what's right, staring right in front of me, I would say there are those two things. And once we have – there's a significant inflow of federal money that comes, because this is a 9-to-1 match, okay? So that's going to take some of the burden off of the private insurers, because they're making up for the charity care that's happening, particularly at our hospitals, okay? So that's one of the ways to do it. The other thing that we have to do is increase transparency. I don't know if there's another industry – or segment of our economy where you go to get something or get something done and you don't know what it costs when you walk in the door. And you don't get the bill for sometimes 6 or 8 weeks later, and you're looking at the bill thinking, well, I don't know, did I have that or didn't I have that, okay? We can do this part better in some of our – by way of enhancing competition, if you will, within the healthcare industry. Where are the best results coming from, and where are they cost-effective? Where are the costs lower? You know, we have some – the beginnings of collecting that data and making it public, but it's limited at this point. So from my perspective, it's difficult to be an informed healthcare consumer, because the information that we need to make the best decisions is not available to us. The other thing that I really want to stress in my 4 years as Maine's governor is wellness and prevention. Most of your employers have figured out that that's the low-hanging fruit. So if you look at state government and how much money we put into health care, and when we bring the federal money in, that's a big price tag. We've pretty much dismantled our public health and wellness strategies. And I'm saying we got to put that back. Most of your listeners, you know, the business people that are operating here in Maine, understand that if we use less health care, it costs less. And we need to take that same approach within state government. We do it with state employees, but we don't do it with our residents and those folks whose health care we're providing in government-funded programs. So a new emphasis on wellness and prevention is a significant part of my plan.
Great. There are many laws in other states that have been proposed or touted to be proposed in the state of Maine. I'm going to go down a list.
Okay.
I'd like to know your opinion in terms of whether you support or think that these are good laws.
Okay.
And would you support them here in Maine?
Mm-hmm.
First, equal pay law, which is basically prohibits employers from paying a lower rate than paid to employees of a different gender or comparable work, or may include rate partly for job titles or experience.
I feel very strongly that regardless of your gender, if you're doing the same job, you should be paid the same. I mean, in terms of the job description. So to me, if that's what equal pay means, that's what it means to me. It means that regardless whether if you and I are competing for a position and the requirements are the same and I get hired and you get hired, I think that we should be paid the same for the outcome. If you have more experience than I do, you might come in further up on the scale, but I have the opportunity when I'm hired to earn that same experience, if you will. But I think that's important. It's really about the outcomes. The business is, you know, my job as an employee is to add value, right? If I'm adding that value, then my gender should be irrelevant in terms of my pay.
How about mandatory paid sick time? Requires employers pay employees part-time or full-time to have mandatory paid sick time?
From my perspective, I'm not ready to make it mandatory. I think what's really interesting is when you look at the earlier statistic that you cited about the 2.7% unemployment rate, you know, workers have choices now. And employers, I think we'll get there, and the market's going to drive it. And I'd rather let the market do that work at this point than making it mandatory.
Some cities already have these that law in place, as you know.
Yes.
Or at least proposing it, I should say.
I'm aware that there are local municipalities that are addressing this, but your question was whether I would pursue that at the state level, and it is not a policy proposal that I intend to make.
How about salary history law? Prohibits employers from screening applicants based on pay history or seeking an applicant's compensation history for current or former employers.
I'm not familiar with it, David, so I think I'd
have
to...
So, giving you an example, Massachusetts, you can no longer ask on an application for what the current salary is. You can no longer ask an employee what their salary is when you get ready to hire them.
And I will tell you that I'd need to read up because I don't have an opinion on it at this point. It wasn't something that was on the radar screen. I'm just curious. It's interesting to read both sides of why one would want that prohibition and why others would not. So I can't answer that one. I'm sorry.
No problem. How about criminal background check law? Ban the box. You may have heard that, where you don't ask or permits criminal history inquiry only after condition of employment. Some of which you can't ask beforehand if they have a criminal history, but once you give them an application, once they're getting an offer, you can then do a background check.
I think that's an effort, as I understood it, to provide more job opportunities for folks who have a negative history or had some infraction and so forth. I'm looking at this and saying, I met this wonderful woman who runs, who's a partner in a manufacturing outfit up in Waterville called F3. They make aluminum truck bodies and stuff. And one of the things she said to me was, I'm looking for folks that are coming out of the criminal justice system because I can put them to work and they're good employees, you know. And she said, and I'm not worried about that. I'm actively seeking them because they need to work and I need them. So, you know, I'm looking at this and saying, well, do we have to regulate that with a policy? Again, we have an unemployment circumstance or, a workforce shortage in such a way that why wouldn't we allow businesses to continue to do that on their own? They might do it to their own detriment if they rule someone out at the front end. But at the same time, it seems just unreasonable to me to say, we're not going to give you that piece of information until you've gotten to a job offer.
And I think that's where employers are concerned, right?
Yeah.
They're saying that, look, we as employers would like to have as much information as possible prior to hiring someone. And some of these proposals, albeit well-intended, employers are concerned about the fact of, you know, why are you mandating that we have to do these things? On the flip side, I can certainly say, employees sometimes say, well, why does it matter? Why should you know that information? And so both sides, fair question. That's why I'm asking them.
Yeah, and that's why with this one, you know, I think that in the employment setting, I guess I wouldn't want to eliminate the employer from asking that question. I think that, frankly, it's probably something that is a matter of public record. It's just whether or not you researched it ahead of time. And, you know, I don't know the nature of the job that any individual, you know, that the employer would have, but there are some circumstances where criminal history would automatically eliminate someone from being hired. So why would you want to go all the way through the process? That's a resource allocation that's unnecessary. So, you know, I would leave that to the business and the owners myself.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Terry Hayes, who's running for governor as an independent candidate. Infrastructure is a big issue here in Maine. Employers are dealing with this, having to do with roads, bridges, physical state structures. Heck, let's even talk cell phones, shall we? Because it's an infrastructure. It's an issue. Heck, I know I was just here downtown Portland, dropped a call. You know, right on 295, right going down the main center of town. It's amazing to me. How do we fix this?
Okay, let's see. Do I have about 90 seconds?
Yeah.
I got this one nailed. Two things. First of all, it'll be three things. The infrastructure in terms of roads, bridges, that piece, we've been struggled at the policy level around the funding mix. because the gas tax is insufficient. Just the way we're using our vehicles and the way we're fueling them and their fuel efficiency has ruled that out as the one source. And we've been really struggled because it's the tax. We're talking about taxes. But let's face it, if we don't pay, our roads are not going to get better. You know, and so finding a mix for what is the appropriate user fees, if you will, if we're not able to use just a gas tax to get at it. And there have been some pretty good proposals, in my opinion, in the taxation committee and struggling to come out because it's, you know, taxes, despite the fact that it's actually a five-letter word, people think of it as a four-letter word. We're going to have to pay for them. You know, we need to be willing to put the money in. So we're putting the money into our cars right now and less of it into our infrastructure. So that's the first piece. I think we have to recognize and be open to that conversation of what's the mix that we're going to need to pay for it. When it comes to cell service and broadband, I mean, those two, I see broadband, fiber, broadband access as the foundation of today's economy. And it is not ubiquitously available across the state. I live in eastern Oxford County, and there are neighbors who struggle to get decent high-speed internet. Yeah. And every business in Maine needs it. If they're not using it now, they're probably not going to be in business 5 years from now. Okay, so every business needs it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's like electricity in that sense.
It is. It's become as important as electricity.
So this is a place where if we can figure out the right mix of users, taxes, if you will, around our roads and our bridges infrastructure, it frees up a good deal of general obligation bond opportunity to raise money to build out the fiber network, which I think we're going to have to do. Right now, it exists where it is economically viable for the private sector, but there are businesses all across Maine that don't have access. So I think that we're going to have some public skin in the game. We'll draw down some federal money, match with some state money. We've got local communities that are doing it now because they don't want to wait. They understand how important it is. So I see that as a real focus for something that needs to be done and that we can accomplish. It'll probably take a 4 or 5 year build out. Because of the amount of money, but borrowed over that kind of that period of time. And, you know, the cell phone piece, it's a mystery to me. It's a mystery to me because there can be a total inconsistency with when you have the challenge. And sometimes I think it's tied to how many other people are on the phone at that particular point in time, and that's capacity of the system. I need to learn more about that, but I know that the folks whom we're all paying because we've got these computers in our pockets and in our purses, you know, it's in their best interest to enhance the quality of that service. We're paying a lot of money. I know I do, you know, in terms of my family for that level of connectivity.
Well, I think one of the things that we talk about, the fact that employers, as you said, it's an essential, the cell phone has become an essential piece. And it just as a side note, I've noticed whenever there is a emergency, right? What's the first thing that goes down is the cell phone service. It's because it just gets overwhelmed. Well, that would seem if more people are getting rid of landlines and we're all going to cell phones. It's not a good idea if during an emergency everything goes down. It just would seem like a state and federal issue at that point.
It's a capacity. It's certainly an infrastructure capacity challenge. I don't know what we currently do to determine what's causing that to happen, and how we, you know, how we stress test it. That's the challenge here. Is how do we? I don't know how we do that or if we do it. I know we do it with, you know, through the emergency response system, but that's not our cell phones. Right. You know, we stress test. You know, even the budget, if you will, at the state level. So, how do we stress test that system to determine where the gaps are in the capacity and then how to backfill those? Those are questions I would need to ask, but I don't know the answers to them.
Okay. Let's discuss the issue of Maine state income and employer taxes. Mm-hmm. As stated, tax revenue is significantly up, you would know, as treasurer. Should employers and even employees pay more or less in taxes? And what is your plan specifically in this area? And what priorities should the money go to in your administration?
Well, in terms of the taxation system, we've attempted meaningful overhaul a couple of different times, and one was beat back by the voters, and then the governor tried some of the same pieces that were in that in a couple of his budgets, and It's interesting because when the Democrats were proposing those changes, that was a good idea. But when the Republican governor was proposing them, it was a bad idea. I'm getting like watching a tennis game here. So I would say to you that we have a challenge around our tax system because of how it compares to our peers. Because when you look across the country, we do not compete well on this point, and it's a constraint within our economy that we need to be aware of. My goal would be, and I can't do this in 4 years, but we can start the path, which is to get the income tax rate down to 5%. That would be wonderful. Part of doing that, though, is going to be broadening the sales tax, which is, again, the same strategy that we talked about before, but being thoughtful and consistent about how we broaden the sales tax. I learned from the gentleman that makes my first cup of coffee in the morning at the Buckfield Mall. His name is Mike. He taught me when I was in the legislature that every single retail outlet in the state of Maine is an uncompensated revenue agent for the state of Maine. And I had never looked at it that way. And I thought that was something important to understand, that absent those efforts and those retail environments, there's a whole income stream that goes away. And how does state government respond? And how do we include those people? Are we grateful to them? Are we helping them get it right, or trying to catch them do it wrong? Those are all pieces of this that I think have to be brought to bear on the same question. But overall, from my perspective, we have to look at our tax system and modernize it. That would be the best way to describe it, I believe. And in doing so, be conscious of how we're going to fit in the overall picture. You know, if we can't be in the middle of the pack, we should be making conscious decisions that keep us out of there instead of just hanging on to the way we've done things now since the mid-70s.
I think a follow-up to that question is we talk about employers trying to bring employees into the state of Maine, mm-hmm. right? And I can say this with absolute certainty because we do that at CMA for my business. We bring employees into the state for employers.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of living, especially around the Portland vicinity, is very similar, comparably, to right around the outside of Boston. Mm-hmm. From a cost of living perspective, we're talking housing, we're talking taxes, we're talking all that aspect of it. Yet the pay in the state of Maine is nowhere near the outside of the circle of Boston area.
Mm.
And that brings a challenge, right, for employers that say, hey, we want to offer X, but you're still going to have to pay Y, and that doesn't equal Z.
Yeah.
For a very simple ABC. Not too difficult. How do we solve that general problem of we're saying that the cost of living similar to a metropolitan area, especially in our biggest metropolis, which is Portland, right? I chuckle, 65,000 people being the biggest metropolis, but we move on. I've lived in New York City. I know it's not. So, how do we solve that problem of bringing people into the state of Maine mm-hmm. and having that issue where we just the cost of living versus the income versus somewhere else is so different? Because saying Maine is a great place to live only works so far.
Well, part of the challenge is to, there's a limited amount of real estate that's inside the city of Portland. And recognizing that you can be nearby but not be there, and housing costs go down some. You know, and the further out you go, if you go out Route 35 a ways, if you go up Route 100 and so forth, there are communities that still have room, that are still growing, and that are more affordable.
Sure, inward, right? Inside.
Absolutely.
Because the coastal areas become...
Well,
expensive.
More and more of our coast is owned by people who don't necessarily live here on a full-time basis, and that's not different than any other part of this country, frankly.
Agreed.
So I guess that's part of why I believe expanding broadband out into the more rural areas provides greater opportunity. It allows businesses. I mean, we've seen some of that migration happen already. You know, there are entities that started in Portland that actually moved out of the city because square foot rental and access to space was prohibitive. They didn't go far. They might have gone to Scarborough. They might have gone down to Biddeford Saco or gone up to Lewis and Auburn. And we're seeing some of that happen as a means of because those communities can be more affordable for different businesses. I struggle with what government's role is in doing that because that's really part of the nature of the way our economy works, that supply and demand component. We have to be cautious around workforce housing. or the people we need to help us keep the doors open and run the place can't afford to live close enough in order to get to and from work. So I recognize that. I think there's some public policy pieces that come around Main State Housing and some of their programs to help provide workforce housing to folks. But in the broader sense, you know, if I'm going to do a job and I can do that job in East Baldwin, or I could do it, you know, in right outside of Boston, why would I want to live in East Baldwin? Because I don't have any traffic, because the air is clean, because it's quiet, because I can, if I happen to be a hunter or a fisherman, I can be out doing that in, you know, less than 30 minutes.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show on WLOB. I'm your host, David Chulo. We're speaking with independent candidate for governor, Terry Hayes. Last question, Terry.
Coming to the end.
Last question. Thank you, by the way, for being on the show. You've been a great guest. Why should business leaders, HR professionals, vote for you as governor of the state of Maine in 2018?
The biggest reason I can give you is that I listen. I listen before I lead. I need to learn. And you've heard me say a couple of times here today that I don't have enough information to weigh in on a particular topic because I'm a work in progress. So I want to know what the challenges are. I want to know what business leaders and business owners think the solutions are. They're not the only voice to consider in answering those questions necessarily. But frankly, you know, right now we're paying into this system, this government system, and we're not getting a whole lot out of it. There's been a lot of gridlock, a lot of conflict that never gets resolved. And yet your taxes, you're still paying them. So this is about outcomes. This is about recognizing that our problems are not partisan and our solutions shouldn't be partisan either. So, you know, I'm open to learning. I know that I still have a lot to learn. I need to know what your listeners, what are of concern to them, and I'll be a better governor because I can listen and because I come at this from the perspective of we can do this better together and inclusive, and that's really my key here.
Well, thank you for being a guest today. If you become governor, will you come back?
I'll tell you this. I'm going to say I'm Terry Hayes. I want to be your next governor, and I would welcome the opportunity to come back. And a whole different set of questions at that point.
Oh, no question. There'll be a whole bunch of different questions. No question.
Well, thank you.
Well, this concludes today's special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, David Chulo. Have had the pleasure of speaking with Terry Hayes, who is running for governor as an independent candidate for the great state of Maine. Her website is Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S, for Maine.com. As a reminder, this was the second of our four-part series for the 2018 gubernatorial interview series. Please listen next week for our third gubernatorial candidate in our series. As always, go to hrpowerhour.com after the show to hear the show again or connect with the guest or host. Thank you for listening. And now your HR tip of the week. Your HR tip of the week is being sponsored by VerylDana.com.
Hi, this is Tani Alvarez at Farrell Dana. Let's pause and think about your highest performing employee, your all-star, the employee who, while not irreplaceable, will certainly adversely affect your operations when they want to leave. Does he or she have confidential information about your business? Do they know information about your profits and margins? The real question is, have you adequately protected your company? A confidentiality agreement or non-compete agreement are, depending on your industry, something you may want to consider. While more and more states are regulating the enforceability of non-compete agreements, a confidentiality agreement will permit you to restrict an employee's ability to share your confidential business information with competitors in the future. Contact a member of Verrill Dana's Labor and Employment Practice Group if you think a confidentiality agreement may be helpful for your company.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerylDana.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBRadio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.